bodily fluid, more or less, won't make much difference by the end of the day. Vladimir shrugged off the burly face dancer guards. His eyes flicked from side to side, suspicious, confrontational. When he saw the chains, the table, and the torture devices, the Golas smiled in anticipation. Krohn gestured to the equipment. "These are for you." Vladimir's eyes lit up. "Am I to learn flaying techniques today? Or something less messy?" "You will be the victim." Before the boy could react, the guards dragged him over to the table. Krohn expected to see a look of panic on the round face. Instead of cursing, howling, or struggling, the young boy snapped, "How am I to trust that you know what you're doing? Or will you mess it up?" Krohn's face formed a gentle, paternal smile. "I am a fast learner." The patchwork emissaries from outside exchanged glances, then continued to watch Vladimir, silently absorbing every instant. Krohn expected to put on a good show for their distant masters. The muscular guards strapped the young man's arms securely in place, then manacled his ankles. "Not so tightly that he can't thrash and writhe," Krohn instructed. "That could be an important part of the process." Vladimir raised his head and turned toward the smiling Krohn. "Will you tell me what you intend to do? Or is guessing part of the game?" "The face dancers have decided that it is time to awaken your memories."
"Good. I was growing impatient."
This Gola had an uncanny knack for saying the unexpected to disorient anyone who might try to gain the upper hand. His very eagerness might be an obstacle to triggering a sufficient crisis. "My masters also demand it," Krohn continued for the benefit of the emissaries who stood against the wall. "We created you for one purpose only. You must have your memories. You must be the Baron before you can serve that purpose." Vladimir chuckled.
"Why should I bother?"
"It is a task to which you are eminently suited."
"Then how do you know I'll want to do it?"
"We will make you want to do it.
Have no fear."
Vladimir laughed again as a thicker band was strapped around his chest. Long needle spikes bit into his flesh to encourage the pain, and Krohn cinched it tighter.
"I'm not afraid."
"We can change that." Krohn gestured, and his face dancer assistants brought forth the agony box. He knew from the old Tleilaxu that pain was a necessary component in restoring Agola's memories. As a face dancer, with precise and intimate knowledge of the human body's nervous system and pain centers, Krohn felt he was up to the task.
"Do your worst."
The boy let out a throaty chuckle. "On the contrary, I will do my best." The box was an ancient device used by the Bene Gesserit for provocation and testing. Its flat faces were engraved with incomprehensible symbols, jagged grooves, and complex patterns. "This will force you to explore yourself." Krohn slipped Vladimir's pale, twitching hand into the opening. "It contains agony in its purest form."
"I can't wait."
Krohn knew that this would be an interesting challenge. For thousands of years, the Tleilaxu had created Golas, and since the time of Muad'Dib, they had awakened them through a combination of mental anguish and physical pain that brought the mind and body to a fundamental crisis. Unfortunately, even Krohn didn't know exactly what was required to accomplish this. Maybe he should have brought pathetic Uxtal from Bandalong for the event,
though he doubted the lost Tleilaxu could have helped much. The barren Gola was particularly ripe for reawakening. Best to proceed vigorously. Krohn fitted a second box over Vladimir's other hand. Here we are. Enjoy the process. Krohn activated both devices, and the young man's body jerked and twisted. Vladimir's face grew white, his pouting lips pressed together over his teeth, his eyes squeezed shut. Spasms rippled through his face, his chest, his arms. Vladimir tried to withdraw his hands. He must be feeling sheer torture, though Krohn smelled no burning flesh, observed no damaged body parts. That was the beauty of the box. Nerve induction could evoke unendurable pain, and it need never stop until the victim's mind was overloaded. "This may take a while," Krohn said, a gentle whisper beside the young man's sweaty brow. He increased the level of pain. Vladimir shuddered. His lips drew back in a rictus, but he did not cry out. Like water from a high-pressure hose, agony streamed into the Gola's body. Next, Krohn thrust needles into the Gola's neck, chest, and thighs, siphoning off the adrenaline-laced chemicals that could be used as precursors for the honored Matre's orange spice substitute. Created with such intensity and purity, Krohn was sure he could sell the product to the honored Matre's on Tleilax. The Matre Superior herself would probably consider it a fine vintage. He could always count on the insatiable needs of Helica's whores. Under the watchful gaze of the augmented emissaries, Krohn would demonstrate a double efficiency. After the torture went on for hours, Krohn disconnected the boxes and looked into the bleary eyes of the sweating young Harkonnen. "We are doing this only to help you." The Gola looked blankly up at him. No flash of awakened memory in the spider black eyes.
"Not that easy."
So Krohn replaced the boxes on the Gola's hands. With barely a second thought, he directed that two more be folded around the boy's naked feet. Four unbearable agonies would hit him. The pain was pure and unfiltered, seasoned with adrenaline and garnished with anguish. The torment continued to pound upon the Gola's mind, seeking to free the locked-in memories. Vladimir twisted, cursed, and finally screamed. But nothing changed. When it was time for dinner, Krohn invited the patchwork representatives to join him. They left the chamber and sat in the dining hall, listening to the crash of the storm outside. Expecting to celebrate success, Krohn had ordered a long and complicated feast. Now they ate each of the fine courses, then returned hours later to the lower chambers. Vladimir continued to squirm, but showed no sign of becoming himself. "This may take days," Krohn warned the augmented emissaries.
"Then it will take days," they answered.
The face dancer began to question his own assumptions, realizing a problem he had not anticipated. Physical pain was not the same as mental pain. The agony boxes might not be sufficient. When he looked down at the thrashing Vladimir, his sweat-drenched clothes, and the defiant grin on his flushed face, the face dancer realized another possible problem. The torture might be ineffective for the simple and straightforward fact that this Gola actually enjoyed it. 19 years after escape from Chapter House. Those who think they see most clearly are often more blind than the rest. Bene Gesserit aphorism.
Shiana danced among the worms again as she had done as a child on Rakkus. Inside the Ithaca's huge cargo hold, the seven creatures rose around her, twisting and waving their bodies like flexible metronomes. They formed a bizarre audience as Shiana stamped her bare feet, flailed her arms, and twirled on the crest of the dune. Among the people of Rakkus, the sacred dance had been called Sihanouk. She kicked up dust and sand with her frenzied movements, losing herself. Sihanouk burned away her emotions and her excess restless energy. The intensity was enough to drive doubts from her mind and misery from her heart. Responding to her dance, the worms pulled themselves high above her and swayed. Shiana drove herself harder. Sweat droplets flew from her forehead and soaked her matted hair. She had to cleanse her thoughts, to burn this fear and doubt from her mind. 3 years ago, after leaving the dead plague planet of the honored Matres behind its failing no-shield, Shiana had felt the dark specter of dismay building in her mind. A world full of dead women, along with their followers and slaves, wiped out by something they could not comprehend, something that had blindsided them. Shiana knew that the hated honored Matres deserved whatever appalling punishment they had brought down upon themselves. But every single person on an entire planet? Surely they had not all deserved to die in such a horrific fashion. And that was only one world. How many other strongholds had been extinguished by the enemy's plagues? How many trillions had perished from a disease with a 100% mortality rate? And how many more would the enemy kill now that the whores had fled like a pack of wild dogs into the vulnerable old empire, drawing the incredible foe with their scent? Shiana tripped in her dance on the soft sand. Regaining her balance, she did a backflip and continued her gyrations. Despite the exertions, she did not find the inner peace she desperately sought. The endless dance only clarified her troublesome ideas. The melange heavy breath of the sandworms drifted around her like the mist of an approaching storm. At the brink of total exhaustion, Shiana collapsed onto the sand. First, she let her knees buckle, then she rolled over, heaving great hot breaths. She lay back, looking up at the high ceiling of the cargo hold. Her muscles ached, her limbs trembled. With her eyes shut, she could feel her heart beating to the rhythm of imagined war drums. She would have to consume a great deal of melange to restore herself. One of the creatures came close, and she could feel the sand vibrating beneath her. She sat up as the monster glided past, pushing up a dune mound and then stopping. Finding a last scrap of energy within her, Shiana pulled herself forward and leaned against the worm's hard, curved rings. It was encrusted with dust, and she could feel the solidity of this thing, the power it contained. She lifted her arm and rested it against the side of the beast, wishing she could just climb up on the ring segments of this worm and ride off to the horizon. But here inside the no-ship, the horizon, the hull, was not far away. Old Shaitan, I wish I had your knowledge. Long ago, when she and the simpering Tliloxu Master Waf and Reverend Mother Odraid had ridden into the desert of Rakkus, a sandworm carried them purposely to the empty remains of old C.H. Tabur. Inside, Odraid had found a hidden message from Leto II. With his incredible prescience, the God Emperor had foreseen that encounter in the far distant future and had left words specifically for Odraid. With such prescience, how could the God Emperor not have predicted the destruction of Rakkus? Or had he? Had the tyrant made his own plans? How far did the golden path extend? Had his supernatural foresight been responsible for Shiana's rescue of the last worm so that it could reproduce on a new world, Chapter House? Surely, Leto II had not foreseen the honored Matres or the enemy of many faces. Shiana wondered if she still saw too little of the overall picture. Despite their struggles, maybe they were all unwittingly following an even larger plan the God Emperor had laid out for them. Shiana felt the pearl of Leto II's awareness in the strong sandworm against her. She doubted that any plan devised by Bene Gesserits or honored Matres could really be more prescient than the God Emperor himself. The desert dragons began to churn the sands again. She looked up to the high plaza window and saw two small figures there, looking down at her.
Dirt is something solid you can hold in your hand. Using our science and our passion, we can mold it, shape it, and bring forth life. Could there be a better task for any person?
Planetologist Pardo Kynes, petition to Emperor Elrud IX, Ancient Records. From the high observation gallery above the cargo hold, two boys peered through a dust-smeared plaza window to watch Shiana and the sandworms.
She dances, said 8-year-old Stilgar with clear awe in his voice, and Shai Hulud dances with her.
They're only responding to her movements. We could find a rational explanation for it if we studied her long enough.
Liet Kynes was a year older than his companion, who showed awe and amazement at the dance. Kynes couldn't deny that Shiana did things with the worms that no one else could do.
Don't try to do that yourself, Stilgar.
Even when Shiana was not inside the hold with the great beasts, the two young friends often came to the observation gallery and pressed their faces against the plaza to stare at the uneven sands. This tiny patch of captive desert beckoned to them. Kynes squinted, letting his vision grow blurry to make the walls of the cargo hold disappear so that he could imagine a much larger landscape. During their intensive lessons with Proctor Superior Garimi, Kynes had seen historical images of Arrakis, Dune. With penetrating curiosity, young Kynes had delved deep into the records. The mysterious desert planet seemed to call to him as if it were an integral part of his genetic memories. His quest for knowledge was insatiable, and he wanted to know more than dry facts about his past life. He wanted to live them again. All of his reborn life, the Bene Gesserit had trained the Gola children for that eventuality. His father, Pardo Kynes, the first official Imperial planetologist sent to Arrakis, had formulated a grand dream of converting the wasteland into a huge garden. Pardo had provided the foundation for a new Eden, recruiting the Fremen to make initial plantings and setting up great sealed caves where plants were grown. Kynes's father had died in an unexpected cave-in.
Ecology is dangerous.
Thanks to work and resources invested by Muad'Dib and his son Leto II, Dune had eventually become lush and green. But as a cruel consequence of so much poisonous moisture, all the sandworms had died. Spice had dwindled to a trickle of a memory. Then, after 3,500 years of the tyrant's rule, the sandworms returned again from Leto's body, reversing the ecological progress and restoring the vast desert to Arrakis. The scope of it. No matter how much battering leaders and armies and governments did to Arrakis, the planet would restore itself, given enough time. Dune was stronger than all of them. Stilgar said, "Just looking at the desert soothes me. I don't exactly remember,
but I do know that I belong here.
Kynes also felt at peace looking at this swatch of a long-lost planet. Dune was where he belonged as well. Thanks to the advanced Bene Gesserit training methods, he had already studied as much background as he could get his hands on, learning about ecological processes and the science of planetology. Many of the original and still classic treatises on the subject had been written by his own father, documented in imperial archives and preserved for millennia by the Sisterhood. Stilgar rubbed his palm across the observation window, but the blur of dust was inside the plaz.
I wish we could go in there with Shiana. A long time ago, I knew how to ride the worms. Those were different worms. I've compared records. These come from sand trout spawned by the dissolution of Leto II. They are less territorial, but more dangerous.
They are still worms, Stilgar said with a shrug. Down on the sand, Shiana had stopped her dance and was resting against the side of one worm. She looked up, as if she knew the two Gola boys were in the observation chamber watching her. As she continued to stare toward them, the largest of the worms also lifted its head, sensing they were there.
Something's happening, Kynes said. I've never seen them do that before.
Shiana dodged lightly away as the seven worms came together and piled one on top of the other, twisting into a single, larger unit that reared up high enough to reach the observation plaz. Stilgar pulled away, more in reverence than fear. Shiana scrambled up the side of the entwined creatures, all the way to the top of the tallest ringed head. While the two Gola boys watched in astonishment, she resumed her gyrations for several minutes, but now she was on top of the worm's head, both a dancer and a rider. When she stopped, the worm tower divided and unraveled into its seven original components, and Shiana rode one of them back down to the ground. Neither of the Gola boys spoke for several minutes. They looked at each other with grins of wonder. Below, an exhausted Shiana walked with dragging steps toward the lift. Kynes considered making some excuse to rush down and speak with her while she was fresh from the sands, as a good planetologist should do. He wanted to smell the flinty odor of worms on her body. It would be very interesting and potentially informative. He and Stilgar both longed to understand how she could control the creatures, though each boy had a different reason for wanting to know. Kynes followed her departure with his gaze.
Even after we get our memories back, she's going to be a mystery to us.
Stilgar's nostrils flared.
Shai Hulud does not devour her.
That is enough for me. I will die four deaths. The death of the flesh, the death of the soul, the death of the myth, and the death of reason. And all of these deaths contain the seeds of resurrection. Leto Atreides II, Dar Es Balat Recordings. Doria's life had become ridiculous, as Balanda within reminded her incessantly.
You're getting fat yourself, said the other Reverend Mother.
It's your fault, Doria snapped. Indeed, she had gained weight, and a significant amount, though she'd continued her vigorous training and exercises. Each day she monitored her metabolism with her own inner techniques, but to no avail. Her once lithe and wiry body now showed noticeable signs of bulk.
You weigh like a heavy stone inside me.
She heard Balanda's chuckle clearly in her head. Grousing to herself as quietly as she could, the former honored Matre tramped up the face of a small dune, slogging through loose sand. 15 other sisters traipsed along behind her, wearing identical single suits.
They chattered amongst themselves while reading aloud from the instruments and charts they carried. This group actually liked doing such miserable work. These Spice Ops recruits took regular spectral and temperature readings on the sand, mapping out the narrow spice veins and limited deposits. The readings were dispatched to the desert research stations, then combined with first-hand observations to determine the best locations for harvesting operations. As the planet's free moisture diminished dramatically, the growing worms were finally producing more melange. More product, as the Mother Commander put it. She was anxious to press the new sisterhood's advantage, to pay for the huge shipments of armaments being assembled on Richesi, and to bribe the guild to facilitate the ongoing war preparations. Mirbella spent melange and soustone wealth as fast as it came in, then demanded more and more. Behind Doria, two young Valkyrie trainees practiced fighting maneuvers on the soft sand, attacking and defending. The women had to adjust their techniques depending on the steepness of dune slopes, loose dust or packed sand, or the buried hazards of dead trees. Feeling the hot blood of her honored Matre past, Doria would rather have been fighting too. Perhaps she would be allowed to join the final assault on Tlilox, whenever Mirbella decided she had gathered enough forces for the great battle. What a victory that would be. Doria could have fought on Boozle, on Gamu, on any number of the recent battlefields. She would have made an excellent Valkyrie herself. And now she was little more than an administrator. Why couldn't she be allowed to shed blood for the new sisterhood? Fighting was her best skill. Trapped in her position, Doria continued to come out to the desert, but she had grown impatient over the years. Am I sentenced to babysit this planet forever? Is this my punishment for the single mistake of killing fat old Balanda? You admit it was a mistake now? Prodded the annoying voice within. Quiet, you bloated old fool. She could never get away from Balanda inside her head. The constant taunting reminded Doria of her own shortcomings and even offered unwanted advice in how to fix them. Like Sisyphus, Doria would roll that boulder up a hill for the rest of her life. And now she found her body growing fat as well. Inside her head, Balanda actually seemed to be humming. Presently, the internal voice said, in ancient times on Terra, people had something called a doorbell, which a visitor rang when coming to a door. So what? Doria said aloud, then quickly turned her face away from the trainees, who looked at her oddly. So that is our combined name. Doria Balanda. Doorbell. Ding dong, ding dong, can I come in? No, damn you. Go away. Fuming, Doria concentrated on the analytical instruments. Why couldn't the Mother Commander find a dedicated planetologist somewhere out in all the surviving worlds of humanity? On her scanners, she saw merely numbers and electronic diagrams that were of no real interest to her. Each day, for 6 infuriating years, Doria had gritted her teeth and tried to ignore Balanda's inner nagging. It was the only way she could go about her tasks. Mirbella had told her to subjugate herself to the needs of her sisters, but like so many Bene Gesserit concepts, subjugation worked better in theory than in practical application. The Mother Commander had been able to mold others into what she wanted, forging the United Sisterhood, even retraining and incorporating some of the captured rebel honored Matres. Though Doria had insinuated herself into a position of power beside Mirbella, she could not completely suppress the natural violence embedded in her nature. The quick and decisive responses that often resulted in bloodshed. It was not in her nature to compromise, but pure survival dictated that she become what the Mother Commander wanted her to be. Damn her. Has she actually succeeded in making me a Bene Gesserit after all? Belanda within chuckled again. Ultimately, Doria wondered if she would have to face off against Mirbella herself. Over the years, many others had challenged the Mother Commander, and all had died in the attempt. Doria did not fear for her life, but she did fear the possibility of making the wrong decision. Yes, Mirbella was stern and maddeningly unpredictable, but after almost 2 decades, it was not so clear that her merger scheme had been wrong. Suddenly, Doria tore her mind from its preoccupation, and she noticed the distant mounds of sand in motion, ripples drawing closer and closer. The voice of Belanda harangued her. "Are you blind as well as stupid? You have stirred up the worms with all your stomping around. They are stunted. That may be, but they are still dangerous. You are as arrogant as ever, thinking you can defeat anything that gets in your way. You refuse to acknowledge a real threat." "You weren't much of a threat," Doria muttered. One of the trainees cried out, pointing to the 2 moving mounds out on the sand. "Sandworms! Traveling together!" "Over there, too," another said. Doria saw that worms were all around them and closing in as if drawn by a common signal. The women scrambled to take readings. "Gods! They're twice the size of the average specimens we recorded 2 months ago. Inside Doria's head, Belanda harped, "Stupid, stupid, stupid!" "Shut up, damn you, Bell! I need to think!" "Think? Can't you see the danger? Do something!" The worms rushed in from several directions. They showed definite signs of cooperative behavior. The shifting lines in the sand reminded Doria of a pack. A hunting pack. "To the thopters!" Doria saw that their group had come too far out along the dunes. The flying vehicles were some distance away. The newly trained sisters began to panic. Some of them ran, sliding in tumbles of loose sand down the slip face of the dunes. They dropped their instruments and charts on the ground. A sister sent an urgent comlink message back to Chapter House Keep. "See where your stupid plan got you," Belanda said. "If you had not killed me, I would have been able to keep watch. I would never have let this happen." "Shut up!" "Those worms are stalking you now. You stalked me, and now they're stalking you." One of the sisters screamed, and then another. More worms rose up from the dunes, homing in on the moving figures. Several Valkyrie trainees stood together, trying to fight against the impossible. Doria stared, wide-eyed. The creatures were each at least 20 meters long and moved with astonishing speed. "Begone! Back to your desert!" "You're not Shiana. The worms will not do as you say." Crystal teeth flashed as the worms darted forward, scooping up sand and sisters, swallowing victims into the furnaces of their gullets. "Idiot!" Belanda within exclaimed. "Now you've killed me twice." A fraction of a second later, a worm rose up, then dove down, consuming Doria in a single mouthful. At last, the irksome voice went quiet within. "The magic of our God is our only bridge." From the Sufi Zen Sunni scriptures, Catechism of the Great Belief. Despite the constant bone-grating fear for his life, Uxtal continued his work with the numerous Waf Golas, and he did it well enough to keep himself alive. The honored Matres could see his progress. 3 years ago, he had decanted the first 8 identical golas of the Tliloxu master that Helica had kept in storage. Accelerated in their bodily development, the little gray children seemed more than twice their actual age. As he watched them at play, Uxtal found them quite appealing with their disarmingly gnomish appearance, pointed noses, and sharp teeth. After undergoing rapid educational impression, they had learned to speak in only a few months, but even so, they seemed feral in a way, tied together in their private world and interacting little with their prison keepers. Uxtal would prod them in any way he felt necessary. The Waf Golas were like small time bombs of vital information, and he had to find a way to detonate them. He no longer thought or cared about the first 2 Golas he had created, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen and Paul Atreides. Krohn had taken them away to Dan long ago. Good riddance. These offspring, however, were his to command and control. Waf was one of the heretical old masters, ripe for re-indoctrination. God had certainly taken a circuitous route to show Uxtal his true destiny. Desperate for spice, the navigators believed Uxtal was their tool, that he was doing their bidding. To him, though, it didn't matter if the navigators reaped the benefits, or if Matre Superior Helica hoarded all the profits. Uxtal wouldn't see any of it. "I am performing holy work now," he thought. "That is what matters." According to the most sacred writings, the prophet, long before he reincarnated as the God Emperor, had spent 8 days in the wilderness where he received his magnificent revelations. Those days in the wilderness had been a time of trial and tribulation, much like the lost Tliloxu race had faced during the scattering, much like Uxtal's own recent ordeals. In his darkest hour, the prophet had received the information he needed, and now so had Uxtal. He was on the right path. Though the little researcher had never formally been declared a master, he nonetheless considered himself one by default. Who else had a greater position of power now? Who else had more authority, more genetic knowledge? Once he learned the secrets locked in the minds of these Wafs, he would surpass any elder of the lost Tliloxu and any old master who had ever lived in Bandalong. He would have it all, even if the navigator and the honored Matres took it from him. Uxtal began the process of cracking these 8 identical golas as soon as they could speak and think. If he failed, he could always try with the next 8, which had already been grown. He would hold them, and all subsequent batches, in reserve. One of the Wafs would reveal his secrets. Within only a few years, the rapidly growing bodies of the initial 8 would reach physical maturity. Though they might be cute, Uxtal mainly saw the children as meat to be harvested for a specific purpose, like the sligs next door in Gaxhar's farm. At the moment, the Waf Golas were running around inside an electronic enclosure. The accelerated children wanted to get out, and each one had a brilliant little mind. The Wafs probed the shimmering field with their fingers to see how it worked and how to disable it. Uxtal thought they might just accomplish that, given enough time. They rarely spoke except amongst each other. He knew how fiendishly intelligent they must be. But Uxtal knew that he was smarter. Interestingly, he observed dissension and competition, but very little cooperation among the 8 children. The Wafs fought over toys and play equipment, over food, over a favorite place to sit, uttering very few words. Were they somehow telepathic? Interesting.
Perhaps he should dissect one of them. Even when they scrambled onto each other's shoulders to see if one of them could leap over the force field, they argued over who got to stand on top. Though the Golas were identical, they didn't trust one another. If he could pit them against each other, Uxtal was sure he could apply the right amount of pressure to wring out the information he needed. One of the children tumbled off the edge of a slippery ramp and fell onto the hard floor. He began crying and holding his arm, which appeared to be broken, or at least severely sprained. To keep track of them, Uxtal had pressed tiny numerical brands onto their left wrists. This one was number 5. As the child wailed, his genetic siblings ignored him. Uxtal told two of his lab assistants to open the force field to let him step through. He was disgusted and impatient with the need to provide unnecessary medical attention. Maybe these children would be easier to control if he just strapped them to the tables, like their sperm donor predecessors. Old Ingva was there as always, watching, leering, and silently threatening. Uxtal tried to concentrate on his immediate obligations. Kneeling by the injured toddler, he tried to inspect number 5's arm to see how badly it was injured. The waff yanked himself away, refusing to let Uxtal near. Abruptly, the other 7 waffs formed a circle around the researcher. When they moved closer, he could smell their sour breath. Something was wrong. "Get back," he barked, trying to sound intimidating. They were on all sides of him, and he had an uneasy feeling that they had tricked him, lured him inside. The 8 waffs fell upon him with bared, sharp teeth, biting and ripping at his skin and clothing. He thrashed and struck back, shouting for his assistance, knocking the small, gnomish Golas away. They were only children, yet they had formed a deadly sort of pack. Were they working together in a hive mentality, like face dancers? Even the supposedly injured boy threw himself into the fray, his broken arm a sham. Fortunately, the waffs were not strong yet, and he sent them skidding across the floor. The anxious lab assistants helped Uxtal keep them at bay while they pulled the shaken researcher back out through the field. Breathing hard and sweating, he tried to gather his composure and looked around for someone to blame. His injuries were minor, only a few scrapes and bruises, but he was appalled that they had taken him by surprise. Left in their pen, the identical Golas ran about in a frenzy of frustration. Finally, they all fell silent and went off to different parts of the enclosure to play, as if nothing had happened. "Men must do God's work," Uxtal reminded himself from the Catechism of the Great Belief. Next time, he would be more careful with these little monsters. Is it enough just to find a home, or must we create one for ourselves? I am willing to do either, if we would only decide. Proctor Superior Garimi, Personal Journals. Another blind jump through fold space. The Ithaca emerged safely, following its random course according to the whims of prescience. With Duncan at the controls, the no-ship cruised toward a bright, comfortable-looking planet. A new world. He and Teg had both conferred on the course, on the wisdom of making another journey at all, even though the hunters had not found them again. And the two of them had brought the great vessel to this place. Even from a distance, the planet looked promising, and excitement blossomed among the refugees aboard the vessel. At long last, after almost 2 decades of wandering, 3 years since the dead No Planet, could this be a place to rest and recuperate? A new home? It looks perfect. Shiana set aside the summary of the scan data, looked at Duncan and Teg.
Your instinct guided us true. Standing with them on the navigation bridge, anxious Garimi looked at the land masses, oceans, clouds. Unless it's another plague world. Duncan shook his head. We're already detecting transmissions from small cities, so there's an active populace. Most of the continents are forested and fertile. Temperature is well within habitable norms. Atmospheric content, moisture, vegetation. It may be one of the worlds settled in the scattering long ago. So many groups were lost, disappearing into the wilderness. Garimi's eyes gleamed. We have to investigate. This could be the place to found our new Bene Gesserit Corps. Duncan was more practical. If nothing else, it would be good for us to refresh the ship's supplies of air and water. Our stores and recycling systems can't last forever, and our population is gradually growing. Garimi blurted, I will call an all-ship meeting. There is more at stake here than simply replenishing our supplies. What if the inhabitants down there welcome us? What if it is a suitable place for us to settle? She looked around. At least for some of us.
Then we will have an important decision to make.
Even with every adult on board in attendance, the Ithaca's huge convocation chamber looked mostly empty. Miles Tegg sat back against a low-tier seat, continually repositioning his long legs. Though he would observe the discussion with interest, he expected to make few comments. He had always followed the mandate of the Bene Gesserit, but at the moment, he wasn't sure what the mandate was. A young man took a seat adjacent to Tegg, the Gola of Thufir Hawat. The heavy-browed 12-year-old did not usually go out of his way to be with the Bashar, but Tegg knew that Thufir watched him intently, almost to the point of hero worship. In the archives, Thufir often studied details of Miles Tegg's military career. Tegg nodded to the young man. This was the loyal weapons master and warrior Mentat who had served the old Duke Atreides, then Duke Leto, and finally Paul, before being captured by the Harkonnens. Tegg felt he had much in common with the battle-seasoned genius. Someday, after the Thufir Hawat Gola had his memories again, they would have many things to discuss, commander to commander. Thufir leaned over, seemed to gather his courage, and whispered, I have wanted to speak with you, Bashar Tegg, about the Serbal revolt and the Battle of Ponciarn. Your tactics were most unusual. I cannot imagine they would have worked, and yet they did. Tegg smiled with the memory. They wouldn't have worked for anyone else. As the Bene Gesserit used their Missionaria Protectiva to plant the seeds of religious fervor, so my soldiers created a myth about my abilities. I became larger than life, and my opponents managed to intimidate themselves more than my soldiers or weapons could have done. I really did very little in each battle. I disagree, sir. In order for your reputation to become such a potent tool, you first had to earn it. Tegg smiled and kept his voice low, almost wistful as he admitted the truth in his own mythology. And earn it I did. He explained to the fascinated young man how he had also averted a massacre on Andioyu, a confrontation against the desperate dregs of a losing army that would surely have resulted in their deaths as well as the slaughter of tens of thousands of civilians. Much had hung in the balance on that day. And then you died on Rakis fighting the honored Matres. As a point of fact, I died on Rakis to provoke the honored Matres, as part of the overall Bene Gesserit plan. I played my role so that Duncan, Idaho, and Shiana could escape. But after I was killed, the Sisterhood brought me back because they considered my Mentat's skills and experiences to be invaluable, like your own. That is why they brought us all back.
Thufir was completely engrossed.
I've read the history of my own life, and I'm convinced that I can learn much from you, Bashar.
With a smile, Teg squeezed the boy's shoulder. Thufir was abashed.
Have I said something amusing, sir?
When I look at you, how can I not remember that I myself learned a great deal from studying the famous warrior Mentat of House Atreides? You and I could be very useful to each other. The boy blushed. When the debate began, Teg and Thufir turned their attention to the center of the convocation chamber. Shiana remained seated in the imposing advocate's chair, a carryover from when this vessel had been designed for other groups. Garimi, as usual, was anxious to provoke a change in the status quo. She strutted forward to the podium and spoke without preamble, loud enough for everyone to hear.
We did not depart on a race or a journey.
Our goal was to get away from Chapter House before the honored Matres destroyed everything. Our intent was to preserve the core of the Sisterhood, and we have done so. But where are we going? That question has plagued us for 19 years. Duncan stood. We escaped from the true enemy who was closing in. They still want us. That hasn't changed.
Do they want us? Garimi challenged. Or do they want you?
He shrugged.
Who can say?
I am not willing to be captured or destroyed just to have your questions answered. Many of us have special talents on this ship, especially the Gola children, and we need all of our resources. The rabbi spoke up. Though he was still fit and healthy, his beard and hair were grayer and longer now. Behind spectacles, his bird-bright eyes were surrounded by a mesh of wrinkles. My people and I did not choose any of this. We asked for rescue from Gamu, and we've been trapped in your folly ever since. When will it end? After 40 years in the wilderness? When will you let us go?
And where would you like to go, Rabbi?
Shiana's voice was calm, but Teg thought it sounded somewhat patronizing. I would like us to consider, seriously consider, the planet we have just found. I am reluctant to call it Zion, but perhaps it is enough to call it home. The old man looked back at his handful of followers, all of whom wore dark clothes and adhered to their old ways. Though aboard the Ithaca they no longer needed to hide their religion, the Jews mostly kept to themselves, unwilling to be assimilated by the other passengers. They had their own children, 10 so far, and raised them as they saw fit. Finally, Teg spoke. According to our scans, this planet appears to be an excellent place to settle. The population is minimal. Our group of refugees would cause almost no disturbance at all to the local inhabitants. We could even choose an isolated spot and settle far from the natives.
How advanced is their civilization? Do they have technology?
Shiana asked.
At least at pre-scattering levels, Teg said. Indications show minor local industries, a few electromagnetic transmissions. No apparent spaceflight capability, no visible spaceports. If they settled here after the scattering, they haven't done any more traveling to other star systems. In running scans of the new planet, he had enlisted the aid of eager young Liet Kynes and his friend Stilgar, both of whom had studied more about ecology and planetary dynamics than most of the adult sisters. All of the readings checked out.
It could be a new Chapter House, Garimi said,
as if the discussion was already over. Duncan's face darkened. We would be vulnerable if we settled there. The hunters have found us several times already.
If we remain too long in one place, we will be ensnared in their net.
Why would your mysterious hunters have any interest in my people?
The rabbi said.
We are free to settle on this world.
It's clear that we must investigate further, Shiana said. We will take a lighter down to the surface on a fact-finding mission. Let's meet these people and learn from them. Then we can all make an informed decision.
Teg turned to the young Gola in the seat beside him and said impulsively,
I intend to go on this expedition, Thufir. And I would like you to accompany me.
In our arrogant assumption of superiority, we believe that our developed senses and abilities are the direct result of evolution. We are convinced that our race has bettered itself through technological advancement. Therefore, we are shamed and embarrassed when something we consider to be primitive has senses far superior to our own.
Reverend Mother Shiana, Ithaca Logs. While the mission to the planet was being assembled, the Ithaca rode unseen in orbit. Though the no-field limited the ship's sensors, it was a necessary safety factor until they learned more about the inhabitants. As the de facto captain, Duncan would remain aboard the no-ship, ready in the event of an emergency, since only he could see the mysterious web. Shiana wanted Miles Teg with her, and the Bashar insisted on bringing the Gola of Thufir Hawat. Physically, he is only 12 years old, but we know Thufir has the potential to become a great warrior mentat. We must encourage those skills to blossom if he is to be useful to us. No one argued with his choice. Concurrent with the fact-finding mission, Duncan made arrangements for a small contingent of workers to go to an uninhabited part of the planet with equipment to gather water, air, and any available food in order to bolster the no-ship's supplies, just in case they decided to move on. As Shiana was finalizing the details for departure, the rabbi entered the navigation bridge and stood as if expecting a challenge. His eyes flashed and his stance stiffened, though no one yet had argued with him or even spoken to him. His demand surprised them. I will go down to the planet with this expedition. My people insist on it. If this is to be a home for us, I will make that decision. You will not stop me from going along. It is my right.
It is a small group, Shiana cautioned. We don't know what we'll encounter down there.
The rabbi jabbed a finger at Teg. He plans to bring one of the Gola children. If it is safe enough for a 12-year-old boy, then it is safe enough for me. Duncan had known the original Thufir Hawat. Even without his memories restored, he would not consider the Gola a mere child. Nevertheless, he said, I don't object to you joining the party, if Shiana will have you.
Shiana does not decide my fate.
She seemed amused by his posturing.
Don't I? It seems to me that all the decisions I make aboard this no-ship have a direct impact on your situation.
Impatient, Teg cut off their bickering. We have had 19 years aboard this vessel to argue amongst ourselves. A planet waits for us. Shouldn't we see what we are quarreling about first? Before she could depart for the planet, Shiana was called to the brig levels by a nervous worker. The Futars let out a great caterwauling, far more restless than usual inside their locked, metal-walled arboretum. They paced, searching for a way out. Whenever they came close to each other, they snapped and snarled, half-heartedly slashing at each other. Then, before more than a few droplets of blood could fly into the air, the beastmen lost interest and continued prowling. One of them emitted a blood-curdling shriek, a noise perfectly programmed to evoke primal human fear.
In all the years aboard the no-ship, the Futars had never exhibited such frantic behavior before. Shiana stood at the Arboretum doorway, looming like a goddess. Against her better judgment, she deactivated the lock field and stepped inside. Only she could soothe the four creatures and communicate with them in a primitive way. As the largest of the Futars, Herm had taken the position of dominance, partly because of his strength and partly because of his connection with Shiana. He bounded toward her, and she did not move, did not flinch. He bristled, showing his canine teeth, raising his claws. "You not handler," he said. "I am Shiana. You know me. Take us to handlers. I have already promised you. As soon as we find the handlers, we will deliver you to them." "Handlers, here." Herm's next words were unintelligible growls and snarls. Then he said, "Home. Home down there." He hurled himself against the wall. The other Futars yowled. "Home? Handlers?" Shiana sucked in a quick breath. "This is the home of the handlers?"
"Our home." Herm came back to her. "Take us home."
She reached out to scratch the sensitive spot on his back. Her decision was obvious.
"All right, Herm. I will take you home."
The predator rubbed against her.
"Not handler. You, Shiana."
"I am Shiana. I am your friend."